Thank you very much for coming to this new session of wider seminar that we do regularly on almost a weekly basis. So for all of you that are new to the seminars, very welcome. So today we have with us Ashwini Deshpande from Ashok University in India, and she's going to explain the reasons that determine labor for participation of women. So the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, and thanks, Kunal, for inviting me. This is a typing mistake. It's not the FESDIC group, but the wider group. This is what happens when you give too many talks here and there. So this is some joint work that I'm doing with Naila Kabir, who's at the London School of Economics. And it's about, as was said before, understanding factors that aid or impede women's participation in the labor force. Eventually, it'll also talk about men's participation, but not today because I haven't yet looked at that data. So anyone who works on labor force participation knows that there are big gender differences in the labor force participation rates in India. And India is, of course, not unique. Pretty much every country has big or small gender differences in labor force participation rates. But in India, the reason that the issue has come to the fore all over again with renewed energy is because the data say that in India, the rate is not only low, but it's actually been declining over the last two decades particularly. And if you look at one of the data sets, which is the National Sample Survey, it's a very big representative survey in the Indian context. It says that in 2011 and 12, the share of women that were working or seeking work as a percentage of women of working age population was 25% in India. And the state that I'm going to be focusing on, I'll show you details about that in a bit. In West Bengal, it's 17%. And this is compared to the global average of 50% and an East Asian average of 63%. Very recently, literally 2 weeks ago, there was another big data controversy in India where the results of the latest report, which the government has suppressed right now, were leaked. And that shows an even bigger decline, even after 25%. So we don't know, that's a leaked report, so we'll have to wait for the official figures to be released. But the point is that it's been declining over the last 25 years or more. And today, my focus is not going to be on the decline. Kunal here has worked on the decline, so he can probably tell you a little bit more about the decline part. But today, my focus is going to be just on the low levels of labor force participation rates, not change over time. Now, one reason that you see the low levels in data, not just for India, but South Asia in general and the Middle East and North African economies, is that women's work is undervalued, both by the households, and women internalize this undervaluation and they underreport their own work. So part of the reasons that explain the lower than average levels in these some parts of the world is because women don't report the work that they actually are doing. Okay, partly it's also a statistical artifact in the sense that what counts as economic activity is fairly restricted, and I'll talk about that in a bit. And so some of the low levels is also because of the definition of economic activity, and if you change that, then you in fact get better numbers for economic activity. And what this paper seeks to do first is that we are trying to suggest some very small changes in the existing National Sample Survey questionnaire, which is the main source of data that talks about these statistics over time. And what we are showing through our survey is that very small changes in the way the NSS asks the question can actually lead to a better enumeration of women's work. So that's something that we want to show. Second, of course, is the larger question, which is that even with these changes, you still have low levels of involvement in paid work. And so what might be the factors that aid or impede women's participation? And finally, we also want to quantify the demand for work that we believe women have, and it's not met. So it's not as though women don't want to work. They want to work, but we need a way to find their demand for work. And so that's something that this paper contributes to. And this is the first of several papers that are going to come out of this project. So there are many other issues related to women's work that this particular paper is not going to cover, but other papers will. Now, as I said, even though the phenomenon of low labor force participation rates for India is not a new phenomenon, there's been a recent renewed spotlight on the problem, not just from the Indian government, but also from international agencies. So now from the IMF, the World Bank was talking about it even earlier, but the IMF, which usually doesn't talk that much about women's work, has now a couple of papers on India's labor force participation rates. And the New York Times has had a few articles. And The Economist, a few months ago, came up with this very provocative cover, which talks about how India fails its women. And the image is kind of, what it invokes is very conservative social norms that are keeping women indoors. So it's, you know, it's kind of evocative. It doesn't say that in so many words, but it's evocative of some very kind of a resurgence of conservative attitudes, patriarchal mindsets, which is somehow pushing women back indoors, something like that. And the rest of the article is also, the way in which it's been written also evokes those kinds of feelings. So for example, it says patriarchal social mores supersede economic opportunity in a way more associated with Middle Eastern countries, enduring stigma of women being seen as having to toil. So it's kind of, it's equating India with a very, if I may say so, Islamicized version of societies where women are not allowed to be outside, etc. Almost verging, you know, moving towards Saudi Arabia or something. Now, there's no, I don't want to comment on the rise of conservative attitudes or not. That may or may not be true. There are certainly reasons for worry, as they are everywhere else in the world. But the data on which this article is based doesn't capture anything in the last 4 or 5 years. So the period which has seen a resurgence of sort of right-wing forces in India, that's not the period that this article, the data on which this article is based doesn't refer to that period at all. So it's making a point about the last 4 or 5 years based upon that data that precedes those 4 and 5 years. So it's more an assumption. And this is a very common belief in the literature on women's labor force participation, not just about India but elsewhere, which is that it's conservative societies, conservative men, very strongly rigid patriarchal norms that are pushing women indoors. You know, this theme. And so The Economist cover also symbolizes that. And this has become a very kind of attractive theme in this research, which is our cultural norms preventing women from working, right? And so that's something that we investigate also in this paper. Now, there's a huge, huge body of literature on these topics, and it's impossible for me to summarize that literature, which has gone back over 4 decades. And this literature looks at both low levels as well as questions of decline. And so there's a lot out there that we know. Some things that we know from this literature is that the way in which labor force participation is measured is critical. And in fact, insights from this literature and insights of work of some of the early feminist economists in India has shaped the way in which data have been collected. So there has been an important role that the measurement literature has played in the way data on women's work has been collected. But of course, there's scope for improvement, and that's something that we suggest in this paper as well. Now, beyond the kind of consensus where everybody agrees that there is an issue with measurement, there is really not that much consensus in this huge body of literature, particularly on the question of decline. Okay, so one school of thought believes that it's the U shape, or some people say the J shaped curve in women's labor force participation, which means that as countries grow richer, women's labor force participation rate declines, either because of household income rising or because women are getting educated more. So they lower their participation in the labor force up to a point, and then it starts to rise again. So it can either be a U or a J, which is a short decline followed by a rise. But the cross-country evidence on this U-shape curve is not that strong. It's mixed. So some countries have seen a U-shape, some other countries have not. In India, if there is a U-shape, we are still on the declining phase So we don't know whether it's going to start rising at some point or what. I mean, it's only time will tell whether we are on the J or the U or whatever else. Okay, and so there's education, there's income effect, there are all of these issues that people have talked about. And the kind of larger question, which, as I said, now particularly amongst economists has made a huge kind of comeback in the literature, is how important are cultural norms as taboos, as barriers preventing women from working? And that's something that we want to, and so even though people talk about cultural norms, a lot of the time it's just a veiled reference to Islam. So is it the case that Muslim women participate in the labor market less? That's often the question, but it's phrased in a different manner. And also because the practice of covering the face is associated, internationally it's associated more with Islam than with any other religion. So covering the face is seen as a symbol for the conservative attitudes, whereas actually in India, Hindu women, those who cover their faces, Hindu women also cover their faces with the sari, the garment that Hindu women wear. They often, if they had to, they would put it around their heads and they would slightly cover their, at least their eyes get covered, right? So that also happens, called a ghungat or a veil. So here what we look for, anyway, I'll tell you a little more about the covering face story. And of course, Islam, some people explicitly talk about the religious barriers. A big theme in the international literature on women's labor force participation or the labor market penalty of marriage and subsequent responsibilities is a question which is the title of Nancy Fulbright's book, which is Who Pays for the Kids? So the idea is that children are needed for the reproduction of the labor force. The fact that children are born and are cared for is a social requirement. But people who pay the price for doing this reproductive work, not just the physical reproduction of the children, but also their care, are women. And so it's a social good. It's something that society needs. But who pays the price for it? Not the fathers, but the mothers, in terms of a labor market penalty. So either women withdraw completely from the labor market, or they take a break, in which case when they come back, they're never at the same level as their as the comparable cohort for men. So they always are at a level. So if you control for age, men will always have higher pay because they've had more labor market experience. So either way, it's a penalty. Or some women come back not to full-time jobs, but to part-time jobs because of the constraints of childcare. So the big issue in the international literature is the childcare. In India, there have been a couple of papers about the marriage penalty, also in the US, which is that if you marry, you see, you know, pre-marriage earnings versus post-marriage earnings, you see a clear decline in earnings of women post-marriage, whereas you see a clear increase in the earnings of men post-marriage. So the marriage penalty in terms of wage penalty is borne by women and not by men. So these are some of the issues in the literature. And we wanted to look at some of these issues in the context of India. As I said before, this paper is about one point in time, so it doesn't really address the question of the decline, not just yet. But we also have some qualitative interviews, and we are hoping to be able to say something about the decline through the qualitative interviews. This is based upon primary data that we collected from 7 districts in the eastern state of West Bengal between July and September 2017. So it's very new data. Why did we choose the state of West Bengal? Because we want the eventual aim, not for this project, but something that we'll do after this project is over, is to be able to compare the data from West Bengal with that from Bangladesh, which is the adjoining, which is another country now, but it's the state that got partitioned at the time when the British left. So West Bengal was in India and Bangladesh became another country. So even though this is a standalone study, Naila Kabir, my co-author, has very similar data from Bangladesh. And so eventually we want to compare West Bengal and Bangladesh to make some conclusions about how, again, culture or cultural norms show up in differential participation rates. And there, of course, it's the other way around, because Bangladesh has higher labor force participation rates for women than India has, or West Bengal has. So the presumed association of cultural norms with labor force participation goes in the other direction for Bangladesh. Anyway, so that's the reason why we chose West Bengal in India and not any other state. How did we choose the districts from which we collected the data? We took two indicators along which we ranked the districts. One was the district per capita income, and second was the share of Muslims. And we chose districts that were high on both of these and that were low on both of these. So we wanted to see the variation in the share of Muslims and whether the district was rich or poor, both of these factors impacting women's labor force participation. Why does the relative prosperity of the district matter? Because it can be a proxy for availability of jobs. So it looks at the labor demand. It incorporates variation in labor demand. It's a rough proxy, but it does incorporate that. And so we chose districts that were at both ends of these two criteria. And we chose the seven districts. Those who are familiar with India would know something more about these districts, but these are the names of the districts. And in fact, here they are. So we chose, you know, Kolkata, North 24 Parganas, South 24 Parganas, and this is Bangladesh. This white thing is Bangladesh right here. So, and then the district of Murshidabad, which is of particular interest because it adjoins Bangladesh, and it also has a high proportion of Muslims within West Bengal, and then these two other districts. So these are, this is the area where, so this is the eastern part of the country, but beyond Bangladesh, again, there's India. So there are the northeastern states that go beyond Bangladesh. So this is, these are the survey areas. And our final sample was 3,701 men, women, and 1,817 women. It was by design that the number of men were half the number of women, roughly speaking, because we, you know, randomly chose half the households where we did both interviews for men and women. But women were interviewed in every household. So that was the how the sampling design was done. Now, our sample is about 57% rural and 43% urban. This is not the underlying population distribution in Indian states, certainly not in West Bengal. So our sample has a greater proportion of urban women compared to, for example, the NSS Employment Unemployment Survey, which is 27% urban. And this again was deliberate because we wanted to, so there's not that much written about or known about urban women, particularly because their samples happen to be small in different national sample survey samples. So we wanted to oversample urban women to understand a little bit more about factors that shape the labor force participation decisions of urban women compared to rural women. And this is the breakup between the districts. As I said before, part one objective of this paper is to contribute towards better measurement and to hope to give NSS, the National Sample Survey, some inputs about how to measure within this, their questions about how to measure economic activity. Okay, and so what we are suggesting is a sequence of questions which are already in the NSS but asked in a particular way that in fact could better capture women's work. Before even the survey was unleashed, we had intensive training of enumerators to sensitize them to the question of what I said in the first slide, which was about low self-reported participation of women. So women tend to deny or underreport their work. And so if enumerators are conscious of this, they are going to make a greater effort to understand exactly what women are doing with their time. And so it was important for women, for the enumerators to be conscious of the fact that women will underreport. A lot of the work will be home-based. A lot of the work would be unpaid, so they wouldn't see it as work, as economic work. And so all of these issues we dealt with in training the enumerators before the survey was launched. Then the NSS question just says, were you involved in any economic activity in the last 12 months? Okay? And that's where it stops. We just added one more phrase to it by asking the same question, but also saying, either earning an income or doing work that you think saves household money. So it's economic activity, but in your view, it's an economic activity that saves house, it's an expenditure saving activity. And we left it to the woman to decide what it was, what it would be. The second thing that we removed from the NSS questionnaire was, the NSS questionnaire asked, were you involved in economic work in the last year for a period of any period of 30 days. So what that means is that if a woman was working, let's say, for 10 days or 15 days, she would not say yes to this because it wasn't 30 days continuously. Right? And one of the things we know from the evidence in India is that the availability of work, particularly in rural areas, has become very fractured. So women are working intermittently at different points, but it's possible that they don't work 30 days at a stretch. So we remove the 30-day caveat, and we also allowed women to assess if their work was expenditure saving rather than income earning, as long as it was economic work. Okay? So that was the first thing that we asked, and we took their, so as I said this already, no restriction on the number of days or whether the work was paid or unpaid. If they said yes to this question, straight away, we count them as working. So this is close to the conventional definition of labor force participation, but with two changes in the NSS questionnaire made here. Okay, so it's a simple yes or no answer. And the idea is that if you say no to it, that's fine. We are just going to ask you a series of follow-up questions. So that was the first, the modified conventional definition, as I call it. To those who said no, even to this self-reported question of unpaid work, we then asked questions which are also in the NSS about a range of domestic duties which are actually economic activities. So this is not about childcare or cooking, etc. It's about activities that are actually economic activities, but women think that these are part of their domestic activities. So, for example, there's a whole range of activities that are asked, each thing in a separate question. So, do you work on a kitchen garden or orchard? Do you rear poultry? Do you husk paddy? Do you make jaggery, which is a sweet thing made out of sugarcane juice? It's sold in the market. And so if you employed somebody to make the jaggery, you would actually pay the person, etc. So anyway, so these are all activities that rural women do. And if the household had hired somebody to do this work, they would actually have to pay them. Right? So these are all economic activities. So they're included in the production boundary. Right? And so for each of these activities, you ask them a yes-no question. And that's what NSS does. But what we did was, we said, first say, did you do this? Yes or no? And then, did you do this just for your own home consumption? Or did you do it because this activity was needed for economic help in your family's business? So supposing the family is making jaggery to sell in the market, and the woman is also making jaggery, she might think of it as just work in the kitchen where you're just boiling the sugarcane juice and making jaggery. So she may not think of it as work, but actually the jaggery is being made and sold in the local market. So it's actually economic activity, right? And so she's not getting paid for it because that's what she's doing as a part of her domestic work, but she can't distinguish between that job of making jaggery versus the regular cooking that she might be doing. Similarly about making mats or baskets, which women do. So if it is done for economic help to the family, then we regard it as income generating or at least expenditure saving work. So all those who said yes to the second question here, so first, did you do this or not? So you say yes, women who will say yes to that. And secondly, did you do it for income generation for your family? You could say yes or no to that question. And if you say yes to that second question, then you're counted as economically active. And these are all women who had said no to the earlier first question. Yes.
Just to understand, sir, if they do it only for the household consumption, it would still be expenditure saving. But
yes, it wouldn't, yeah. But I'm going to come to that in a bit. That's why I'm going to argue that these boundaries are very fuzzy. So it's subjective to a large extent. So the thing that was happening, to reveal the answer to your question already, is that if you counted all of those, then it's 100%. So all the women are working, right? And so then there's no variation. So that's the reason. So I presented this to another audience, which is all very feminist women. And they were very upset with me saying that, how dare you say that those other women are not working? That's not what I'm saying. All I'm saying is that if I include that, then it's 100% labor force participation, right? And so you have to find some cutoff, and this is a rough cutoff, but it's there. So anyway, so now we have a measure of economically active women who didn't say yes to that first question. We also checked whether households possessed land and livestock, because there's a huge amount of anthropological and ethnographic material which says that if women are land-owning households, or if they possess livestock, women always work either on the land or the livestock, whatever they possess. I mean, there's no way that these things get taken care of without the women working on them. So we checked those and counted them as economically active. And just to make a check that we were not overcounting too much, although I think we are undercounting economic activity, but to take into, because I'm an economist, I work with economists, their point will be, oh, you're overcounting. So to take care of that question, this is also in NSS, which is, why are you still pursuing domestic work? Okay, if the women said, we are pursuing domestic work because there is no other work available, non-availability of work, then they get counted, you know. So these women who say that the reason that they're doing domestic duties is because there is no work available, then they get counted as economically active. So this, in my view, is an undercounting, but it's a balance between overcounting and undercounting. And so it gives a measure. And so the extended definition of labor force participation rates now is economically active, calculated in the way that I have explained, plus the earlier definition, which gave the working women, quote unquote. And so this together, two together, will give the extended definition of labor force participation rates. So if you actually now count from our data the working women plus these economically active women, we get a labor force participation rate of 52%, which is, I think, lower than what, Kunal, you've got for, but our methodology is different. Anyway, so we get a labor force participation rate of 52%, which is more than double the 25% that NSS had got in 2011 and 12 for the state of West Bengal. And this is just 7 districts, right? Now, important to note, because in the feminist literature, there's also this big debate about whether the routine care or reproductive activities of cooking and caring and cleaning and taking care of children, is that not expenditure saving? Is that not economically useful? Of course it is. Okay, and so there's a very dominant school of thought that believes that all of those activities should be counted as economic activities. Right? But that's debatable, because again, as I said, you know, if you count that, then all women are working all the time. Right? And so what I want to emphasize here is that this 52% that we are getting is not by counting the care work or the reproductive work into economic work. This is just by better capturing standard economic work. Right? So you might like that or not like that. But
the first question, I think it was ambiguous enough to be possible that some women were considering domestic chores.
Yeah, that's the thing. It isn't, because we have a lot of questions about domestic chores. And so they understand.
But also to those who said yes to the first question.
Right. So they understand the difference between domestic chores and the, if they were only doing, so they err in the other direction, which is that they think of economic activities as domestic chores, but they never, if they didn't do any economic activity and they were just taking care of children, I mean, they don't misunderstand in the other direction. I haven't seen that. And it also doesn't come out in ethnographic accounts, that they would misunderstand their regular, just cooking, for example. It's the other way around. Even if you were running, for example, in India, we have this tiffin service where you cook at home and you make little lunch boxes and you supply them to offices. So many women who do that will not say that they were working, even though it's an economic activity. But you'll never find a woman who's only cooking and saying, no, I'm doing an economic activity. You know, so the error goes in the other direction, right? So the point to be noted here is that the 52% is coming by including activities that are in the part of the production boundary, the standard production boundary. So it's not about the debate that talks about changing the production boundary. That's not what's happening here. It's just better measurement of activities that fall within the production boundary. And all other women, we counted as unpaid / out of the labor force. So I'm not using only out of the labor force. because precisely because of the question that you asked, which is always there's always this fuzzy boundary between are they not also doing expenditure work. So for example, 63% of these women who do at least one of those long list of activities that I've listed earlier, 15% do three, and fewer percentages do many more. Some people do everything, all of those activities in some measure or the other. And so there's always this gray area about some of these women should also be counted as economically active, but we had to make a reasonable cutoff, which we hope will be acceptable to a wide, I mean, there'll always be quibbles about some boundary or the other, but in our view, we have actually put a conservative estimate that, you know, people have been pushing us to move it broader, but then we are going to get a backlash from the other end, so we've kind of, but even then, you know, just by these few tweaks to the NSS questionnaire, we get a better measurement. And the reason that we have made a few tweaks and not come up with a completely new questionnaire is because if you want to sell this to the data collection agencies, agencies are very reluctant to make complete overhaul of the way they've been doing things. It's much easier to make them accept small changes rather than saying, okay, everything that you were doing is wrong and now start from scratch. That's not going to be acceptable, right? So well, right now, I don't know, but after the elections are over, maybe we'll get an audience with the new people in charge, and let's see. If we get any traction, then we would like to sell our new method of asking these questions. All of these activities are expenditure savings. So even those who are unpaid or in the OLF, out of labor force category, they also do expenditure saving activities. So we are not denying that at all. But based upon their self-reported descriptions and based upon them saying no, 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 even after two or three questions, we are saying, okay, you are either unpaid or out of the labor force and we are clubbing you all together. But of course, the point is that the boundary between what we are calling OLF and economically active, that boundary is fuzzy. It's not a very sharp boundary. And we could be making an error either way. So the colors are not looking great here, but basically now look at, this is by district. And if you look at the blue line, which is working in our estimate, and you look at this another different blue line here. On the So compare the first line and the last, first bar and the last bar. The first bar is our estimate, and the last bar is the NSS urban estimate. And the purple bar is the NSS rural estimate. NSS gives separately for rural and urban. And in every district, in the case of every district, our bars are higher than the NSS bars, whether purple or blue. So, you know, I already said that. So the point is that it's possible to get better measurement with some small, I mean, the starting point is that you have to be convinced that there's a problem there's a problem in the method with which a labor force participation is being measured. If you agree, then we can have a conversation about how that bias can be reduced. And so that's something that we are hoping to contribute to through this. These are just some descriptive statistics. It's a bit small, the table, I'm sorry. It's working, economically active, and out of the labor force. They're pretty similar. So age is about 36 years. These are the caste categories, the proportion of Hindus, proportion of Muslims. Now again, already here you see in the overall sample, about 67% are Hindus and about 31% are Muslims. And if you look at their distribution across the three categories, it's pretty similar to their overall distribution. So already you can see that religion is not playing that much of a role here, and indeed it will turn out to not play a role later on. Female-headed households, you see that if you're female-headed, much more likely to be in the conventional working definition than not. Monthly per capita expenditure, which is a proxy for income, is not surprisingly higher when women are working. But it could be, there's no causation here. It's just that when you have a working woman in the household, your income expenditure is going to be higher, etc. These are so the domestic chores, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. We collected data on specific domestic chores that usually data sets don't have information on, because we wanted to measure the effect that it might have on labor force participation. Okay, so here just look at the, we wanted to see whether there's, even in terms of the descriptives, whether there's a U or a J shape going on here. So if you just look at the working, these are illiterate women, women with primary education, women with secondary education, women with post-secondary. So when you go from illiterate to secondary, you feel like, okay, maybe there is some kind of a U shape. But again, when you go to post-secondary, it changes direction again. So nothing much there, really. Not a very obvious U shape here. These are just, you know, monthly per capita expenditure, and these are the productive assets, just some indication of the wealth. And here you definitely see that the richest households, because these are assets owned by the households, in the richest households, women are, you know, the proportion of women that are working is really very small, much smaller than in the others. And it's the middle, the second quartile of households where you find the highest proportion of working women. Not even that much very poor women. So it's a, again, a kind of a mixed picture, not a very clear, some inverted U actually, more than U going on here. So, and then the way in which you measure labor force participation is, of course, a multinomial logit. And here, the reference category is out of the labor force. So all the estimates I'll show would be being in either the working category or economically active category relative to being the unpaid out of the labor force. So that's really the base category. And the standard variables that get used in all such regressions, we have all of them: age, age squared, rural urban residence, educational categories, caste, marital status, and household size. These are fairly standard in this literature, and we have all of them. What is new about our regressions is there are two sets of covariates that typically don't get captured in data sets. One is the effect of the domestic constraints, and this we measure by three variables. One, is the respondent primarily responsible for childcare? Okay. Is she primarily responsible for elderly care? And how many of these five domestic chores is she primarily responsible for? So there are other categories where she's not primarily responsible, but she gets help, typically from other women in the household, not so much from the spouse. But here, what we are taking, it, we classify it as one. If the respondent is primarily responsible for these chores, so it's cooking, food, cleaning, dishes, washing clothes, household maintenance, and collecting water. And I would just like, because I'm talking to an audience outside India, I would like to point out that actually these are activities that get done every single day in households, sometimes twice a day. So cooking, for example, in a household that doesn't have a refrigerator, they will cook twice or thrice, make breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Okay, clothes get washed every day because often people don't have enough clothes. There's no place to store them, etc. Houses get cleaned every single day, right? Because it's not dustproof. Houses get very dusty. So even the poorest households. So these are activities that take up actually a lot of time, and they have to be done every single day, sometimes multiple times in a day. And if the woman is primarily responsible for these chores, then that does mean that these are serious constraints on her ability to work outside the home. Okay, and so I think that it just needs to be emphasized at these points, which is that it's not something that you do once a week. You collect all your clothes for once a week laundry, or make food and freeze it, or eat out. So these are not still that common, except in some urban households. So these are very important issues that don't get highlighted that much in the literature, because they are particularly unique to South Asia and some African countries. Okay. And the second set of covariates is what I was talking about as the effect of this sort of conservative attitudes, because covering the face is seen as acceptance of a conservative mindset, or is seen as, you know, willing acceptance of patriarchal values or whatever, you know, and so we ask the women, do you cover your head sometimes, always, or never? And if she said sometimes or always, we classified that as a one. and then never is never. And so never is the base category. And so this is the kind of a proxy again for cultural conservatism or cultural norms that we've estimated for. So these two are the new sets of variables that typically you don't find in data sets because these questions are not asked of women. Okay, so these are, and so what I'm presenting are average marginal effects because for the predicted probabilities, because in one sense they give a better picture of the effect of that particular variable because you're measuring the average across all possible values of these variables. And what you find here is that marital status matters in the sense that if the woman is separated or divorced or widowed or never married relative to being married, then she has a higher probability of working, which is the first category, relative to not working. Okay. Now, while this is true, it's also a fact that the majority of the women in our sample and indeed in India are married. So marriage is very close to being universal in India. It used to be completely universal. Now it's less universal than earlier. But so even though it's an important result, it's not very practical because you possibly cannot say that in order to increase your labor force participation, you can opt out of marriage because that's not going to happen and nobody's going to listen to us. So yes, it's an important issue. And so there is a marriage penalty as we see, but it's just to our minds, it's really something that you put in a graph, but it's really not a very practical issue that you can raise in the South Asian context about marriage. So what do we find there? The caste differences, interestingly, maybe because it's Bengal, yes, 5 minutes, are not that significant. Education, relative to being illiterate, all other educational categories have a lower probability of being in the labor force. Childcare, actually, the woman being primarily responsible for childcare doesn't change her probability of working relative to not working, but domestic chores, the graph has got a bit compressed, but domestic chores, these are those 5 chores, they actually make a difference in terms of, they reduce the low probability of working. And here is the probability of the economically active category, and the variation is much more. You can see the confidence intervals are much wider. So it's a little bit, as would be expected, it's a little bit of a fuzzy category. But here again, you see it's the opposite direction. And so relative to being out of the labor force, urban women are more likely to be working, but less likely to be just economically active, etc. And domestic tasks. Now, here, so I don't know if you notice the cover head variable here. So a cover head also actually has zero effect on the probability of working. And again, those who live in India are not surprised by this result is because actually women who cover their heads, and the same thing is true in Bangladesh, is actually they feel it's easier for them to go out and work because partly the signal, it's a signal to society saying don't, you know, stay away. And partly if there is any opposition at home, you take care of that by saying, well, I'm covering my head, so don't worry about it, you know. And so it's actually paradoxically, regardless of our individual views on covering head or not, in terms of an aggregate social impact, it's actually paradoxically it gives women the ability to move away, out. And let me just point out that in the Western literature, as I talked about earlier, childcare is seen as a key impediment to labor force participation rates. But in South Asia, actually, it's domestic chores more than childcare that is an impediment. And this is a result that you see also from some other studies. Here is a study that was done in 4 countries. And here again, I don't know whether you can see that. Sharing of tasks in nuclear and extended families. And you see here, for example, that household work, both in nuclear and in extended families, it's really household work where the woman is primarily, so the woman respondent only is the blue line, blue bar. It's much more for household work than it is for childcare. And again, we can talk about that in the discussion, but the simple answer is that childcare often tends to be much less supervised in most South Asian families. In some urban South Asian families, it's very much like the West, where every minute of the child's life is highly supervised. You cannot leave the children alone. But most of the time, children are just hanging around doing something on their own. And as long as somebody broadly keeps a watch, it's okay. And so childcare is not, and often women who work on farms or construction sites, you will see, if you've been to India, you'll see children are taken there and they're just left on the ground to play. But whatever it is, I'm not saying that's the best way to raise children, but it's certainly the case that it doesn't pose such an important impediment to working in a way that domestic chores do. So we want to bring attention to, now that I don't have time, I'll just quickly talk about this unmet demand for work, which is 74% of respondents who don't work, who are out of the labor force, will say that yes, they will work if work was available, made available to them in a way that it's compatible with their domestic preoccupations. And this brings me to the last, so this is a demand for work graph. Maybe I'll come back to this in the discussion. What I really want to point out is that the way in which the cultural norms are defined in this whole discourse on women's labor force participation, the whole definition of cultural norms rests on conservative attitudes, patriarchal attitudes, covering your head, etc., etc. What we want to argue through this paper is that there are cultural norms that prevent women from working. But the real cultural norm that prevents women from working is the fact that they are seen primarily responsible for housework. And so we want to redefine, or we want to appeal to our audience that think of cultural norms as the cultural norm that holds the woman responsible primarily for housework. If that were not the case, you wouldn't see the kinds of results that you see. So instead of focusing on who covers the head and who doesn't, maybe we want to see why is it that we can't generate a culture that asks that everybody shares in the housework. And that's the real cultural norm that is a barrier to women's labor force participation in India. Thank you.
Okay, we have some time for questions.
I was just wondering if you could give some indication of what's going on with the elder care, because I think in the graph...
Yeah, so elderly care is very much like also domestic chores. In the sense that...
The other direction.
Other direction from childcare.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ah.
The other direction from childcare.
So it does prevent...
It does prevent. Because the thing is that we, again, in India and in South Asia generally, there is... Elderly care is still at home. You know, bulk of elderly care is done at home.
Sorry, I thought it was going in the opposite direction.
Opposite direction to childcare.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it's the same... it has the same effect as domestic chores, because the elderly have to be fed and taken care of. And if you're not going to get help for that task, then it's literally like you have to cook an extra meal or something. So it adds to the same effect that the domestic chores are adding. And whether you are the daughter or the daughter-in-law, it's the assumption is that because you're the woman of the house, you are the one who's going to take care of the elderly. Yes.
One thing is, I think there is some difficulty in separating the effects, you know, for example, between social norms and chores, being responsible for chores. Because, as you mentioned, probably social norms work, making women responsible first for domestic chores, and only if they are not needed for that, then they can go work outside somehow. No?
That is what is the reality. I'm saying that needs to change.
No, of course. Yeah. But I mean that somehow I'm not so surprised that the proxy for social norms in terms of the being covered or not is not that relevant once you are controlling for the main consequence of being conservative, for example. That
we tried it without the domestic chores as well. So the cover head variable, no. And this is not just our study. You know, so again, you don't have data on this variable that much, but there are ethnographic accounts of women's work, and also in Bangladesh, you know, in the Bangladesh data, you find that women who cover their heads or faces, it might symbolize other things, but it doesn't interfere with their labor market participation. That's all I'm saying. We can talk about what else it might signify, and that's a separate discussion, but in terms of their labor market participation, it doesn't. I mean, you know, there are There's a neighborhood in Delhi, in the city where I live, which is a very, you know, Islam, Muslim-dominated neighborhood. So, but it's a very elite neighborhood. So the core of it is a very elite, the creme de la creme of the Delhi society live there. But the domestic, all the domestic services are provided by the surrounding neighborhood, which is very, you know, which is majority Muslim. And so they find this amazing site where the girls who come to help in the housework, they come covered with their head, and as soon as they reach the house, they take it off. And then they're wearing jeans and t-shirts, and, you know, it's just their point is that if we just wear that, then it's just easier for us to come to work. It's very practical. Yes.
Yeah, very interesting work.
Thank you.
I was thinking of the richer women.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting that they don't want to work more. One thing is probably that their education is still lagging behind.
No, it's the opposite. So the richer women are also highly educated, and there the issue of the quality. So that's the work that I'm doing right now, which is looking at the kind of work that women are doing and the kind of work that women want. Educated women and richer women are not going to settle for any old work because they don't really do, they're not doing it for the money. They're doing it because they want to do a particular kind of work. And if that work is not available, again, through this leaked report that got published in different newspapers in India in the last 2 weeks, the rate of open unemployment, and India has never had a problem with open unemployment. It's always been underemployment or disguised unemployment. But the rate of open unemployment, you know, for urban women is the highest of all social groups. It's 10%. And so that's because they are well-educated and they wouldn't settle for any old job that is available. And good quality work right now, the creation of good quality jobs in India. So India is going through a big employment crisis right now. And what this is, so it's because it's measuring the reduced form, which is the outcome. So you don't know how much of it is demand and how much of it is supply. But in the case of the, if you put two and two together from another data source, you can, it's reasonable to infer that the low labor force participation among the richest women is because of the fact that they're not getting the kind of work that they would like to do. Yes. Yeah, so we do control for household size, and we also have information on labor-saving gadgets. And we actually find, that's a regression I didn't show you, but it was a few slides up. We find that we take very simple devices, so nothing very fancy like a dishwasher or anything, but even something like having a pressure cooker, you know, reduces the woman's exclusive responsibility of a domestic chore. So very simple things that middle class or lower middle class Indians would be able to afford actually reduces the woman's sole reliance, household's sole reliance on the woman on domestic chores. So other people are willing to help out more, even if, but it's a, that's, that makes the causation really messy, because obviously working women are more likely to also have these gadgets. So it's not, you can't say that they went out to work because they bought a pressure cooker. They went out to work and therefore they got a pressure cooker, right? So it could be, yes.
Considered other regression techniques as well. I'm thinking specifically about latent class and more kind of cluster type data driven methods, because what I think would be interesting also very much of course from the policymaker perspective is to capture different hindrances to women going into the labor force. The usual regression techniques, you kind of pin it down on one thing, everything else equal. But we do know, and that's important for policymakers, it's actually groups where often three things come together.
Mm-hmm.
Something, there's not a specific opportunity, they don't have the capabilities, and there's not an incentive. And then there's different versions of this.
Hmm.
There has been actually this, I don't know if this has ever been applied to developing countries, but OECD has had a series of studies applying such method to different OECD countries. I find that work very interesting also from the perspective.
I would love to hear more about it. So
yeah, please
do share.
I'll send you the link.
Please, definitely. I would love to, because I do, I realize that, I mean, for economists anyway, there's not enough causal stuff here because there's no exogenous, right? So there's that issue anyway.
Yeah.
But I would love to do as much as I can with the data.
Yeah. And I love your last point. Again, having worked on kind of service for couples, the domestic chores, even far outside India.
It's not just great.
No, no, yeah, yeah. Of course, you know, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. I also enjoyed the presentation enormously. So in your conceptualization, you treat culture as an explanatory factor. And I wondered whether we should also be thinking about culture as an explanandum, as something that can be changed.
Hmm.
And it occurred to me, as you were just talking a moment ago, about some of these labor-saving technologies that might, in fact, reduce the constraints on women in the household. So one of the possible implications is that if, say, rural India were to modernize, if the chief constraints are the need to be able to have to fetch firewood, the need to have to fetch water, if they had electricity supplied, if they had water supplied,
yeah.
If you were to modernize, if the state, in other words, to provide some of these services, it would then save the labor for the women, whether that would then in turn change the cultural norm. So rather than having to try to think we're going to kind of engineer this by focusing on culture and we need to change these cultural norms and the balance of power between men and women in the household, but actually address this indirectly by thinking about the state providing some of the ways to reduce the labor that's unfairly burdening women at the moment.
Absolutely. I mean, there's actually an OECD study that shows that if... So it's based on 5 or 6 countries, not South Asia, which also shows that if... Precisely what you're saying, which is that if these services were either provided for or that there was a greater household participation in getting this work done, it increases women's labor force participation rate. So there's no doubt that I couldn't agree with you more. It's just that I don't know, India's in a lot of turmoil these days and a lot of flux, so I don't know what will happen a few months down the line. But I mean, it's possible that it will get done. On the other hand, who knows? Anything is possible. So we'll see. After the elections, we'll see where we are headed. Yes.
Ashwin, that was a very, very nice presentation, very nice paper. I had a question. You know, so, for example, one could argue that there is something else that's jointly determining amount of involvement in domestic chores and whether women are working or not, which is the women's bargaining power in the household, the women that cannot be empowered. So, you know, there's this surveys out there which actually measure the woman as decision-making power with the budget of the family, whether she can go and visit the parents without asking her husband's permission. So that kind of captures what essentially is the latent bargaining power she has in the household, which will explain to some extent whether she, you know, she can negotiate with the husband, whether she needs to do cleaning every day or cooking every day, and also explain whether she will take part in the labor market or not. So I'm just wondering, some latent variable out there which is essentially driving both sort of, you know, both the covariant and your dependent variable, which could be actually, I mean, I don't know if you have got questions.
Yeah, we have a whole question set, two modules on empowerment and, I mean, decision making and autonomy and mobility and all of those things. It's just that I don't know which is driving what is driving what. So I think there are these three corners of the triangle, and the fact that she can bargain with her husband better or with the family better, is it that she, because she's working outside the home and earning something, that she's able to bargain better? Or is it because she's able to bargain better, she's going outside and working? It's hard to answer that.
Or she has a harder time to bargain at home because she needs to make up for the fact that she goes out work.
Yeah.
And you see that for the US happening.
Yeah.
So the unpaid work at home actually of men goes up as long as women keep earning until then. And when women take over the men, the income, then women overdo the unpaid work at home.
Because, because they feel guilty,
yeah,
and they
that's the
they feel they need to compensate. And so we do have a module on empowerment, and we are going to analyze it. It's just that I'm not sure which way the direction is going,
yeah,
you know.
To
it's
be
hard
honest,
to...
I don't think we'll get causality in there about this.
It's just something we're going to look at, these work categories. And by the way, so then the working women, we further subdivide into formal wage work, informal wage work, etc., which is the second paper. And so we are going to look at various indices of empowerment by the kind of work they do. You know, so the preliminary result is that the more they are in formal wage work, paid work, they are better. They do better on the indices of empowerment. But I don't know. I mean, you know, I have an open mind about this. Which of these three is the latent variable? I don't know. Yes.
Yeah, thanks for presentation. I come from a world of development practice and us. So I have a slightly different question. You said that when you're making the definitions of one real criteria of waste that you wanted to make something with sort of a usable, marketable to the National Bureau of Statistics, having small changes but not too big changes.
Hmm.
So my interest is that did you go to the National Bureau of Statistics and did you try to sell your definition?
No, I didn't go. Because first, it's very new, and we just got these results. And again, those of you who've been following the Indian news in the last month, there's been a lot of turmoil in the National Statistical Organization, the National Statistical Commission. My friend and colleague from the Delhi School of Economics for several decades, she in fact just recently resigned from the National Statistical Commission. So there are issues going on. It's been headline news. And so this is not a good time to go to them. There are going to be elections in May, and I think we'll all wait for the elections and see what happens after that, and then...
But one thing you can do is, for example, since the motivation was the underestimation of work made by women, is to analyze, to characterize what kind of women are underreporting their work, no? Because somehow you can check what kind of women say no to the first question, but then you... They
kind
say
as
yes,
in
they have economic
but
activities. In
by kind, what do you mean? What kind?
No,
kind measured along
the
which
kind, the same type of regression, but working with one definition and not with the other.
So that's already there, no? So the first graph was only the working that said yes to the first question.
The first one. What you
and the second
is only the first.
And
one.
The second
okay.
one is only the second
yeah,
one, not
yeah,
both
yeah,
together.
Yeah.
So think of three categories. One is clearly working.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One is economically active but not working. And everyone else is in the third category. And so the first graph was working relative to the third category. And the second graph was economically active relative to the third category.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you didn't,
yes.
Like coming back to what you were asking in the beginning, that's the first group who said yes to the first question, you didn't further disaggregate. Because, I mean, you may have some people that said yes, because they correctly understood that they do something, but they're very close in their activities to those who initially said no, and then you discovered they do.
So, no. So, you know, I'm using the word work in English, but actually in the Hindi or the Bangla, the Bengali translation of this question, what is referred to as household work,
mm-hmm.
there are different words to describe that. And what we think of as economic work, there are different words to describe that.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, when we piloted it as well, and even earlier, you know, there's not much ambiguity about that. So as I said before, you might be doing economic work, but because you don't get paid for it or because it's home-based, you might think of it as domestic work. But there is absolutely no evidence so far, at least, to think that women who do only domestic work confuse it for economic work.
No, I was just thinking to regrouping not by question, but rather by in paid salary work outside the home and home-based.
Yeah, yeah. So the second paper, which is these different categories. So there we ask them two. We don't even again go by what they define. So first we ask them modes of payment, so paid monthly, paid weekly, paid regularly, etc., etc. And then location of the workplace. Is it in your house? Is it in your employer's house? Is it at a third workplace? Is it a concrete building, an office, or is it a moving workplace? Moving workplace basically means if you're selling vegetables on a cart, the cart will keep moving. So that shows informality, so things like that. So we use both of those, then we make a matrix of both of those criteria to then infer, to make our selections, so that we don't rely on different assessments of people. So those are more objective yardsticks. So that's the second paper, actually, where we look at the types of work. And again, as I said before, you know, you could... I'm not saying that these are producing absolutely clear-cut, watertight boundaries. No. It's just a rough cut. But even with the rough cut, I think we still, the figure of 52% cannot be seen as huge overestimation of women's involvement in. If anything, we think, both of us, Naila and I, our hunch is that it's an underestimate. Of course, we can't prove that, but so it's a kind of a lower bound of the true extent of women's economic participation. And with the caveat, which we absolutely believe, is that with these fuzzy boundaries, but then NSS is not doing any better either, neither is the census. So, you know, we are all in this gray area where people are trying to grapple at the problem, you know, and so we are just suggesting yet another way of doing it, with no claims to it being the absolutely the correct way of, or anything like that. Yeah.
Okay, I think we are running out of time, so thank you very much.